I was over in
Wellington, right?
Well, I was actually thinking that it was where we did the
in presentation, the forum, yeah. Yep. Yeah, then we would have liked to have the classroom, actually.
It should work out.
Yeah, we're going there. She's the one.
Potentially not. Okay.
Great start to the day, Robert.
It's a Monday.
It's a Monday. Morning, everybody. While we're waiting for me to get organized, I'm going to change. I'm not going to log in as Dr. Cooper. Can I ask? Well, let's start with this. I'm Ken Campbell. I'm in the physiology department. Can I ask how many of you read either of the papers that were sent out to you?
One of them.
One? Okay, good. Emily did more than one? Anybody?
Are they on campus? Where is that?
Which one?
Did you know that you were asked to read papers? Okay.
Which paper?
Okay, so which papers did you read last week?
It was the striated muscles, but they covered this a little bit.
Okay.
So they do know.
So we're really going for it today. This is a perfect start to the day. So I was under the impression that we were going to do two papers, one today and one tomorrow. And clearly that hasn't happened. So that's okay. That's okay. This is good, because this is going to be a great chance to have an informal talk, and I'll talk to you about a whole bunch of stuff. So this is going to be really good. So I did my undergraduate degree in physics, and then I went to do a PhD in sports science. And I thought that I was going to be sort of trying to combine sort of physics and sport. And I ended up doing a PhD essentially in how, well, some pretty fundamental properties of muscle mechanics. Right, so I spent a lot of time measuring muscle contraction and force and stiffness and things like that. So I did my PhD in Britain. And then during my PhD, there were a bunch of experiments that I wanted to keep doing. I didn't think I'd done enough for my PhD. There were things I wanted to follow up on. And I went to Madison, Wisconsin, for what I thought was going to be a year to finish off the experiments. And I ended up spending 6 years finishing off the experiments. And then in 2004, I was recruited down here. And I've been here since 2004. And now I run a lab that primarily tries to help patients who need heart transplants. So now what I think about is I'm still interested in muscle and the contractile properties and so on. But now, if I'm going to do an experiment, or if somebody in my lab is going to do an experiment on muscle, there's a 95% chance it will be a piece of cardiac muscle rather than a piece of skeletal muscle. Okay. So I got to Madison in April 1998, and I spent a year trying to work out, like, how to do anything. And then I spent about a year writing some software to do experiments. And I published a pretty big paper in the Journal of Physiology in 2000. And I think probably about 50 people read that. And then I worked for another 2 years on this paper. Okay? So this was really, but I couldn't have done this paper without the 2 years building up to it. So this was basically about 4 years' work after having done a PhD for four or five years on similar sort of work. And I think that sort of at the time, this might actually be technically the best piece of work I've ever done, in my opinion. It's not the most impactful. It's not the most, it's not the one that's been cited the most. It's not had the biggest impact on the field. But this was a really solid piece of work that I was very proud of. And to be honest, now it's, 15 years later, I'm still quite proud of it. I look back and think, how on earth did I actually do this? Okay? So, you are going to hear a lot about history dependence of muscle, because I bet Dr. Butterfield is going to talk a lot about things like force enhancement and so on. But this was me getting into, well, I guess this was sort of like 7 or 8 years worth of me thinking about the history dependence of muscles. And this was the first time I had worked on rat soleus fibers. So, soleus muscles, do you all know where the soleus muscle is? Okay. And in a rat, it's, I don't know, probably at least 90% slow fibers. And the 2000 paper, the one that came before it, I basically tried to do the same experiments on soleus fibers. Do you know about the soleus muscle? Okay, where's the soleus in a human?
Hip flexor.
Okay, so I'm rubbish in anatomy, okay, but the soleus muscle in a rat, this is how you get to it. I suspect you get to it differently in a human, but in a rat, what you do is you kill the animal, you open the chest, you sort of cut right down the middle, and you sort of pull the chest open, and you flip it on its side, and all the guts come out, okay? So then you poke around, and you look for the spinal cord. And the psoas starts somewhere about here.
I thought you were saying soleus.
Soleus, and then there's soas.
Okay, we're good now.
Okay. So the soas in a rat starts by here, inserts into the bone somewhere, and goes down somewhere here, but I never worked out where the end of it. Is that the same in that?
The same image, yeah.
It starts this high?
No, it doesn't start that high. No.
Okay.
It starts in the lumbar spine, like L1, L2.
Yeah. Okay. So in a rat, I think it's pretty darn high. Okay. Yeah. And it's quite big, and it's nearly all fast muscle. Mm. Okay. So, what I wanted to do in these experiments was I basically wanted to sit there and be able to stretch, do lots of things. And in our experiments, the psoas muscle,
Got it.
Okay. That wasn't robust enough in the sense that you'd stretch it a few times, and the seventh time you stretched it, you didn't get the same force records as you did the first time you stretched it. And a friend of mine, Kerry, who's now at the University of Missouri, said, oh, like, we've never really done much work in it, but, like, we put in a soleus muscle just for the heck of it once, and it was, like, indestructible. And suddenly, I mean, I tried once, and suddenly I could do all these experiments I've been trying for ages to do in the fast muscles, and they just worked in the soleus muscles. So that was that. So
are you going to explain why the fast muscle didn't work as well as the slow? Or is there something to this?
I don't think we know.
Okay.
So we'll make sure that this paper is available to you.
Okay, well, they're now on campus. Everybody's now on campus.
Fair.
a little bit late, but they're there. I'm sorry.
Realistically, we'll probably get to figure 3 by Wednesday. So, but some more issue bumps. So this was a figure that I made. This was to show basically the apparatus. So we're going to put a single muscle fiber, and it's going to be about the width of a hair. Okay, so maybe about 50 to 60 microns across. We're going to attach single muscle fiber to a motor and a force transducer. And here's a microscope picture, and this is low and high activation, and I'll talk a lot more about this later on. Okay? But this is the muscle fiber, back side view, and these vertical lines running down, they are the striations. Okay? So in between two black lines is the sarcomere. So now the next thing I want to do is I want to talk about compliance. So if I, is that a great, is the best place for me to draw over there, actually?
Draw over there.
I don't need
one.
Sorry.
There.
So, imagine I've got a muscle fiber, and it's, I don't know how I'm going to do this.
I can see what you're doing.
Okay, so imagine I've got a muscle fiber, and I'm going to fix it at one end. Okay, and then I activate this muscle fiber. It's going to develop force, and it's going to shorten. Okay? So there's going to be some connection, and I'm going to draw that as a spring. And what is going to happen when I activate this muscle is it's going to shorten, and it's going to stretch out that spring. Do you see that concept? Now, imagine, do you all know what stiffness is? Do you know an equation for stiffness? Hooke's law. Hooke's law, perfect, that's awesome. So, F equals K delta X, or delta F, delta F. Change in force is some constant times delta F. So what I want to do is I want to measure this stiffness, K. So I'm going to do it by putting in a delta X, I'm going to stretch the muscle, and I'm going to measure the change in force. So the problem is that I'm going to stretch this muscle by pulling on this end. The problem is that when I put that stretch in, some of the stretch is going to extending the muscle, and some of it's going to go into extending my connection. And now do you see that it's quite hard to work out the stiffness of the muscle because you don't know the change in length of the actual contractile machine. See that point? So that is what this crazy red thing is. Okay? So the red thing is you take a laser beam, and honestly nowadays you do it with a pointer, a laser pointer, and you shine the laser beam up through the muscle fiber. Okay? So why is that interesting? It's interesting because if you have a screen and it's got little holes in it, and you shine light up through this, if the holes in the screen have some separation that is comparable to the wavelength of light, you get diffraction. Have any of you ever heard of that before? Did you ever talk about diffraction grating or anything like that in any of your classes? So what you might think would happen is you shine the light through and you get a series of light stripes coming out. But if the spaces between the slits are comparable to the wavelength of light, you actually get most of the light coming out straight, and you get some of the light coming out like that, and you get some of the light coming out like that. And it turns out, so some of the light comes out like that, some of the light comes out like that, some of the light comes out like that. And it turns out that if that is theta, d sine theta equals lambda, that's the wavelength of the laser beam. And that is the separation between the slits. So the angle depends on the separation between the slits. And if you shine that laser beam through the sarcomeres act like slits, and the angle at which the light comes out tells you about the sarcomere length. So that is a technique called laser diffraction. So the way it works is that if I stretch this muscle, I'll pull all these sarcomeres slightly further apart. And what actually happens is that as you pull the sarcomeres further apart, the sort of side arcs come in. Right? So if I pull muscle, these two orange things go like that. So if I'm changing the length of the muscle, the orange things will go like that. So if I measure the position of one of these spans of light, essentially what I've got is I've got a measure of the sarcomere length. And the great thing about that is you can do it a few thousand times per second. So it's really no different than you coming up here with a ruler and taking a picture of it and doing like 20 sarcomeres equals so many microns. But you can't do that very quickly. Right? So the nice thing about this is you basically project laser beam through, you get a signal that is indicative of the sarcomere length. And now what you can do is you can work out how long the sarcomeres are. And if they're too short, you just sort of stretch the muscle a little bit. And so you get what's called a control loop. So it's a little bit like the thermostat in this room, right? The thermostat in this room, the temperature is drifting up and down. There's a little sensor on your thermostat that's saying, is it too cold? If it's too cold, let's heat the room up. Is it too warm? Oh, if it is too warm, let's cool the room down. And so I'm constantly measuring the sarcomere length, and I'm constantly adjusting the length of the position of the motor to keep those sarcomeres exactly where I want them. Okay? That turned out to be something that took me about 4 years to do. Right? It's quite hard. I had to write a lot of software, spend a lot of time thinking about how to do it. So that was 4 years. It led to about 3 or 4 papers, and we still use the software every day in the lab 20 years later. Okay? But it was really hard. Any questions about that? Big picture, it was a way to get the best measurement of muscle stiffness that we could get, because it's change in force over change in length, and this was a way of getting a very precise change in length.
So, okay. Would you just pick like one or two sarcomeres to look at, or would you look at it only in the belly, or would you kind of take samples throughout the muscle that you're looking at to look at the sarcomere length? Keep it constant.
So you would do a single fiber, and you would try and control it. Basically, you measured the laser beam going through the fiber, which was basically about 90% of the length of the fiber. So you tried to get the average sarcomere length in the middle of the prep. And later on, you and I can talk offline about why we don't do this anymore. Okay. Right, so that was that. So now, boy, this is sensitive. Right.
So this is probably the critical figure in the whole manuscript. So the y-axis here is force normalized to cross-section area. So you know that muscles that have a big cross-section area should produce more force than muscles that have a small cross-section area. So this is basically units where the cross-section area doesn't influence the force. Here's the sarcomere length change. And here is whatever we need to do to the fiber length. So that's the us moving the motor backwards and forwards. And so basically, this triangle should look fairly similar to this triangle. And any difference is going to be due to that stretch in the end. So let's just talk about these two cases for that. So I should have to give you a bit of background here first. So, you've got a muscle, you've got a T-tubule, you've got an SR, which is the calcium store, you've got the myofilaments, which is what I care about. Okay. And have you done a little bit of excitation contraction coupling and action potentials and calcium release? Okay, perfect. So, what I did in these experiments was I used a type of prep that you probably haven't heard of before, which is you take this muscle fiber and then you put it in a detergent. And detergent is kind of like the stuff you use to clean your dishes. So detergents work because they eat away at fats. And the membranes are made predominantly of fats. So if you put it in a muscle fiber in detergent, you destroy the membranes. So you end up basically blasting holes in all the membrane structures. Right? And that's good because you can take your muscle fiber and you can just move it into solutions with different calcium concentrations. So now what happens is the calcium floods in and it fills the space around the myofilaments. So on a slow time base, this is force, this is time, and this is low calcium and this is high. And you switch there, so what would happen is force would be low, and then force would start to activate, and it would stay high until you moved it back into a low calcium in the windshield would drop back out again. So this is a so-called permeabilized preparation. It's only for experiments. This is not what happens in real muscles right now. But what it allows you to do is it allows you to do a constant level of activation. And you could sort of do that with a fused tetanic contraction, but then you could only do it at the highest possible calcium level. Now what you can do is you can have intermediate levels of calcium, so you can have low a little bit, halfway, 75% full activation, just by moving the muscle to different calciums. Okay? So this is probably,
if I zoom this just slightly to the right, it says steady state tension 0.46 of maximally activated tension. So this is 46% maximally activated. That's that level of force right there. Okay. So you give it a stretch, and boy, we could speak literally for, well, I could speak literally for like the next 3 months about what happens during this phase of the stretch. Dr. Butterfield could as well, he's an expert in this too. So what happens is force shoots up really quickly, and then it
drops down a bit, and then it looks like it's sort of staying in a plateau. Okay? So the force, you got a stretch, you're just going from there to there. The force shoots up, drops down a little bit, stays in the plateau as long as you stretch. And then when you shorten the muscle back down, you get this big drop, and you come way down, way below your original isometric force. So this behavior here is what's called the short range stiffness of the muscle. So straight off, you need to get away from the idea that muscle has a sort of standard length tension. Right? Because what you've done here is you've changed the length, and you've had a huge change in force induced by that. And it's very complicated. Right? So I think the first line in the paper says that muscles are stiff for small motions. And that's an example of the muscle being stiff for a small motion. You've got a length change here. Let's get this right. What's a typical sarcomere length? Do you know that? So 3.65 would be the length at which there's no overlap between thick and thin filaments. So it is a sarcomere length, but it's a bit long. So, I mean, a ballpark would be 26, 27 nanometers. So this whole length change is about 100 nanometers. So 100 out of 2600. So we're probably at about 3 or 4%. So that whole length change is 3 or 4%. But you went from about 30 to maybe 45. So an almost like 50% increase in force just in the very little beginning of that stretch. So if that whole thing is 4%, maybe a 1% change in muscle length gives you a 50% increase in force. So that's very stiff. Very small length change gives you a big increase in force. So what do you think that is? What do you think that is? A 1% change in length gives you a 50% change in force. You think it's Titan? Have you heard of Titan? Okay. What do you think? What could it be? What produces force in muscles? Tell me some things that produce force in muscles.
Actin, myosin, binding.
Good. Anything else?
Titan's responsible for passive stretch. For
okay.
Passive force.
What else might give you some force? Maybe in a whole muscle.
Your tendon.
Yeah, I would say that the tendon connects the muscle, so if you're going to force the muscle, you have to force the tendon, but I'm not sure that...
Force production maybe is not...
What about collagen? I mean, I suppose there's collagen in the tendon, but there's collagen in the muscle too, so if you stretch the muscle, you have to stretch the collagen. So these are, you know, there's probably some collagen. There's not much collagen in a single fiber. There's titan,
factors activize it. He didn't say the word, but I'll say the word, cross bridges. You have to have cross bridges. So could somebody tell me what a cross bridge does? I'm not looking for magic, right? Okay, I'm just looking for a very simple one sentence description of the thing I have spent 30 years studying.
So the cross bridge is the binding site for actin and myosin, where the myosin head will bind to actin and then cock back, creating a contraction, will shorten the myofibril.
Okay, so I like nearly all of what you said, but I might just rearrange a couple of bits to make it perhaps just a little bit more like how I think about it. Because the terminology is a bit confusing. There are actin filaments, and there are thin filaments, which are made predominantly of actin. There are thick filaments, which are made predominantly of myosin. And the myosin a single myosin molecule is a big long thing with a neck and a head. And if you put 300 of them together, all these broad bits wrap together to form a big thick filament. And then you get pairs of heads coming out. With a sort of defined symmetry all the way along the front. Right? So, if a myosin head, well, myosin heads always want to reach out and join the thin filament. And they are normally prevented from doing that because the thin filament is switched off. But if you switch the thin filament on, the myosin heads, which are always knocking on the door, can attach. And the convention's a little bit tricky here. I tend to think of a myosin head as being a crossbridge. But I think originally crossbridge was only if you had a cross link between the thick and thin filaments. So I tend to say a myosin head is a crossbridge and it could be attached or detached. But some people would say a crossbridge has to actually be something joined between the thick and thin. So a myosin head is going to reach out, it's going to attach to actin, and then what's it going to do?
Change its position.
It's going to change its position, so it's going to have a conformational change that is tied to ADP and phosphate and things like that. It'll have a shape change, and thus it will generate force. And now it will force generation between the thick and thin. Okay? So, a sarcomere is, you know, of order, we just talked about this, of order, you know, 2600 nanometers. These experiments were done with the sarcomeres fixed to 2600 nanometers. How big is a myosin head? Is it 2600 nanometers?
Like 2 nanometers?
Well, that's a not bad guess. Okay? I mean, it's hard to know exactly, and it depends sort of how you measure it. But a ballpark is about a 5.
I would have won if this was the Price is Right.
You would have won if this was the Price is Right. Okay? So I'm a 5 nanometer crossbridge, and here's our sarcomere length change that is a total of 100. But we can, if that's a sarcomere, each half sarcomere will do half that. So each half sarcomere is going to do 50 nanometers. So this whole length change is 50 nanometers per filament. Okay? And it looks like something dramatic happens, what, about there. So maybe you get about, I don't know, a quarter of the way along, right? You maybe get 10 nanometers long and something happens. Does that help you a little bit? What causes... Okay, let's break this down a little bit more, right? If this was Hooke's law, if this muscle looked like Hooke's law, what would this force record look like?
If the muscle...
So Hooke's law is for springs, right?
Right.
If the muscle was a spring, and you stretched it, what would that force record look like? Be linear, right? So let's do that as well. We've got force, length, time. We did some sort of stretch. If the muscle is a spring, it's going to go. What actually happens is it goes. So it starts off as sort of like a spring, and then something catastrophic happens, and it's no longer a spring. Okay? And that length change happens, according to our measurements, to be about 10 nanometers per filament. What do things happen?
Your cross-bridges for your myosin has disconnected. To then have, because they can only go so far, so then
yeah.
They have to disconnect to then reconnect.
Oh boy, that's a very sophisticated answer. Okay. So that was really good. So I thought you were going to get like half marks, because I thought you were going to say you pulled on the cross bridges and they disconnected. So if you pulled on the cross. Right. So do we see that that 10 nanometer length change is about the size of my. Comparable. So it's like I grabbed onto the table and you have pulled the table 2 miles to the left. I'll be able to hold on for the first like foot and then that table's gone and I can't stop it. That length change is very, very, very big relative to the size of my head. In this case, 10 times as big. Right? So you pull me, I break, I let go. If everything let go, what would happen?
Has to be pulled back to the normal length.
Passive would pull it back to the normal length. That sort of might happen in a real muscle, but this is an experimental situation where we're controlling the length.
There's just no force.
There's no force. You would actually get passive force. You'd get whatever the Titan was giving you at that point. So what you might expect is force goes up, you break all the cross bridges, and force plummets down to something like close to zero. Because passive tension is not very high. What actually happened is force goes down and it stays at some plateau. And that plateau would keep going as long as you kept stretching. Now you... Sorry, what's your name?
Emily.
Emily. So Emily came up with what is a very sophisticated part, the second part of the answer. Can you remember what you said?
They have to reattach.
They have to
after
reattach.
They move back, they reattach.
Okay. So what happens is you pull some cross bridges off, but other cross bridges are coming along behind. Now, a lot depends on how quickly those other cross bridges come on behind. So if they come on relatively slowly, you'll get some sort of like frictional sort of resistance, but that frictional resistance might be quite low. So what you might get is you might get a big flat, a big spike, and you pull them off, and then force would come back down, and it might sort of stay along this level. Or if they reattach very, very quickly, you might get something that's sort of like, it's sort of a more rounded curve. So what you've got here is you're not quite able to replace the cross bridges quickly enough to keep you at that max force. It's dropped down just a little bit, but they're reattaching relatively quickly. But you might imagine the relative height of the plateau is going to tell you something about how quickly the cross bridges are attaching during the motion. So that was very sophisticated. You have a future, Emily, as a molecular kinesis. Okay? Even if you didn't know it before that. So we've got about half an hour left.
Yeah.
Would it technically be reattached, or would it just be others that are attaching?
Ah, that's an even better question.
So, you know, if one is turned off, and then others are using that system.
Yeah, so that's a hard thing to measure. It's probably that you have a family of myosin heads, and when you pull some of them off, then somebody from the family, it could be the same head coming back on, it could be different heads. You don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
What if, like, the thick filament acts as the mechanical sensor itself, and also the more stress that's on it activates more myosin heads, you know, and that's why you see that initial overshoot, because the body just overshoots, not knowing how much force is going to go. And then once it figures out, like, I can sustain using this number of myosin heads, you know, why waste time and energy with this, and I can, you know, do what I need.
So were you at my talk the other day? When I talked about that?
I was, but I don't.
Okay, so the latest theory, and it's literally just of the last year, is that there are changes in the thick filament when this happens. Okay, so what you're saying is very interesting, and it's something that I'm actually running some simulations on at the moment. But that was that. What do I want to say here? I want to say for this class that we've got some complicated molecular kinetics where you're pulling myosin heads off, and some myosin heads are attaching to, are continually attaching. So now we've got a balance between how quickly we're pulling the heads off and how quickly the other ones are attaching. And that can get very complicated, and you're right, you can get changes in the number of bridgeable myosin heads, but that's not built into the theory that was the second half of the paper. You probably shouldn't be able to know about it at the time. Okay? So the second thing I want to say is, let's look at the second stretch. Do you see that the second stretch has a pattern that is very, I mean, in some ways it's very different than the first stretch. But in some ways it's actually quite similar. Because you stretch, and it looks like we've got two phases, right? It looks like there's a phase going up like that, and there's another phase going up like that. And it turns out that the length change to get that break, that length change is about there, is pretty much the same length change as you got the time before. And then this maneuver, which it's called a KTR step. Basically, what you do is you take the muscle and you shorten and then you re-lengthen. And that length change is very big and it's very fast. And the goal there is to break all the active myosin bundles. So it's basically going like, boom, like that. I don't care if you're attached, I'm ripping you off. Okay? So now, force is going to come back up. And so there's some sort of curve to that. And so what does that curve tell you? I've ripped all the myosin heads off.
Is there reattaching?
It does tell you reattaching, but if I'm going to measure something from it, what would I get by measuring that curvature? Excellent. I get the rate at which the myosin heads are generating force. So if they generate force really quickly, you can come
boom, straight back up and then be flat. But if it takes them a long time to develop forward, this is going to be like, okay?
Figure two. Not bad. 47 minutes. Okay. You should come to one of our lab meetings. This would be considered too fast for one of our lab meetings. Okay. So, here's
figure three. So now what we're looking at is a whole bunch of records. And this is maximum activation and minimum activation. So I'll talk just a little bit about that over here. So now I'm going to talk about calcium concentrations. So we talk a lot about PCA, and PCA is just like pH, which you've heard of. Okay. So what that means is PCA is minus log the base 10 of the calcium ion concentration. So PCA 9 is ten to the minus 9 molar, which is 1 nanomolar. PCA 6 PCA 6 is a micromolar, and PCA 3, which you never, that's way too high for biology, is a millimolar. So it turns out that PCA 4.5, that turns out to be 31.6 micromolar. That's 10 to the minus 4.5. I'm sure you all knew that. Just implicitly in your head, 10 to the minus 4.5. And 31.6 micromolar, that's saturating calcium. If you had more calcium than that, you would get more force. And 6.5, this is now down at about 200 nanomolar, something like that. So the relevant range of intracellular calcium for activation is, you know, a few hundred nanomolar to a few micromolar. Right? So low activation, high activation. And now our time record here is 10 minutes. It's 10 minutes along the bottom. And each one of these little spikes that you're going to see is actually a pair of stretches, just like we spent half an hour looking at. So, one pair, one pair, one pair, one pair, one pair, one pair. 10 minutes, max activation, and this is showing a blow up of these two, and this is showing a blow up of these two. And they're not identical, but they're pretty darn close. And so what I was doing in this record was I was adjusting the time interval between the stretches. And I was trying to do this in a sort of consistent way. And I needed the muscle to be stable over the experiment, because I didn't want the mechanics of the muscle to be sort of changing during the experiment. And so this was an experiment, or this figure demonstrated that I had a stable muscle prep. And this was, I think, I ended up with about 90 minutes of activation. It's maybe not in this figure, but on a single fiber, and the thing was like a long. And to give you an idea, when I was doing the psoas muscle, which is a fast muscle, I would get to right here and force to go like, bleh. Okay, and so I was never able to measure the history dependence of the stretches, because I couldn't have a stable prep to do that.
So I was unbelievably proud of that figure. Okay.
Why did you choose 10 minutes?
I chose 10 minutes because
I think what I was doing, I think each record was like 15 seconds long. And I think I wanted, I think I had something like 10 conditions. And so I had 10 times 15, and then I wanted to do it 3 times. And that was 10 minutes.
So let me show you. I'm skimming through a few sugars. I'm going to show you this.
So, remember I said I'm varying the time interval between the stretches? Right, that's why I did that. That's what this looked like. Force triangles, and so the black line here stretch way long time, another stretch. And so there, this is very low activation. A weird little blip. It's not the same as you saw before, but it's similar. Right? So you wait a long time, and you do it again, and lo and behold, that force record moves quite much. That force record. But if you do the session stretch immediately afterwards, it looks different. And you can see that as you increase the time interval between the stretches, the force records get more and more similar. So that's in the full activation. And then there's like 4 other panels on that figure at different levels of activation. And what we're doing here is we're quantifying it. So the red was stiffness. So what we did for stiffness was measured the rate of change of force divided by the rate of change of length. So it was K is change in force divided by change in length. So we measured the stiffness of this initial phase here. And since these two look the same, the stiffness, the relative stiffness of the second stretch by the first stretch, that should come back towards 1, which is this dashed line. But the blue line, this is force, this is basically force at the beginning of each stretch. So it turns out that force drops more than stiffness and comes back with a rate constant in this case. I mean, the stiffness is a little bit slower to come back than the force to come back. This is a logarithmic time scale, so that's a millisecond, 10 milliseconds, 100 milliseconds, 1 second. So it looks like it went up to about 7 or 8 seconds between stretches, and that was enough to recover sort of the mechanical history. So it looks like the muscle's got a sort of history of about, or a memory that lasts about 7 seconds in this condition. Right? If it's more than 7 seconds, it doesn't go to something like that. Okay?
Zooming back, I'm zooming back to show you.
So this is a different record. So we, the very first figure we looked at, this, something that looks a bit like this. This is showing you low and high calcium. So this line at the very bottom is the passive property of the muscle when calcium is 1 natrium. So that's as low as you can realistically buffer calcium. So we have done as much as we can to turn off the contractile. And that is probably coming almost entirely from titanium. Okay. When you increase calcium, you activate the contractile apparatus, see that as you stretch it, as you activate it, this blip gets bigger and bigger. So that's consistent with Emily's idea that what you're doing is you're stretching bicep heads. Because the more activation you have, the more steady state force you have, and the more force you get when you stretch those heads. And you can see that it's history dependent at all these levels. So the second stretch doesn't look like the first stretch at any level.
What is the physiologic?
So that's a really good question, and it's hard to know because physiologically muscles probably transiently activate. So Dr. Butterfield may have more physiologically relevant answer than I do, but I would say that the majority of motions that people make are unfused tendon. Is that fair?
I agree.
Right? So what that means is that calcium is probably going up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. Right? I think it's very rare for a person to be able to do a maximum voluntary contraction where they really are maximally activated, so that calcium is presumably at a steady state level. And I think it is also quite difficult to completely switch off your contractile machinery. Right? So I think even when you're relaxed, even if there aren't action potentials around, I think there's probably basal activation going on. That may or may not be calcium dependent. But I think if I'm sort of walking around like this, I don't think I have a stable calcium concentration in the muscles that are activated. I think it's coming and going. I would guess it is around PCA6, but it's not fixed. Okay.
So that was showing calcium dependence. Oh, this is good. Or I think this is good.
This orange record is measured in PCA3. Okay? That's as low as we can get calcium. This green record is measured at PCA6.5, so I don't know, like at 100 nanomolar or something like that. And there's a very prominent short range response. So you look at that green record and you go, yeah, this makes sense, CrossFit G is pretty long. And most people wouldn't look at this in this level of detail, but I had spent 5 years doing this, so I spent a lot of time. You see this orange record's got a blip? It's not, it doesn't look like a green one, but there is a little curve there. And do you see that it's gone, the next one? And do you see that the blip happens at exactly the same length change as it does in the green one? I think that that is pretty good evidence that that there are a small number of myosin heads attached in minimal calcium in these slate fibers. Right? I mean, I went looking for that because I had done my entire PhD on livid relaxed fibers. Right? So I had gone looking for that, and I probably wouldn't have noticed it if I hadn't gone looking for it, but there is a little bit there. So I think there's a small number of myosin heads attached even when calcium is very
What else do I want to say? I want to say, we'll do one more figure and then we will maybe take some questions and then maybe I'll talk about what you want me to do on Wednesday. This is a
summary figure that was basically just me trying to measure everything I possibly could about this behavior that I had spent a
So here's force as a function of calcium. So here's a sigmoidal relationship. So this is basically showing the activation dependence of force as a function of calcium. You can see the midpoint of activation here, 5.92, so just a little more calcium than PCA6. So it's, you know, 1.2 micromolar or something like that for half activation. This is something that we talked about, that the stiffness of the muscle is going to increase with the steady state force. So the fact that this line is pretty straight, especially at the low end, is pretty good indication that your initial stiffness is coming from stretching, the same thing as generating force. This is showing you how far you have to stretch the muscle before you get detachment of myosin heads. And it turns out to be about 5 nanometers, perhaps, on your low end, at low activation, and maybe getting up towards 10. I am not super, I'm not totally sure if this is an activation dependence. It looks like it, but I'm not really sure if the myosin heads can actually stay on longer at high activation or not. I don't really have an explanation for that, although the data are pretty clear on that sort of terms. And D is more complicated than you probably want to get into. So that was, I think, to be honest, that probably still is the best characterization, the best measurements of the short-range properties of permeabilized rats, lace fibers that have been done. They were technically very sophisticated for the time. I would like to think that if other people did the experiments, they would get the same numbers that I did. That's basically it. It was a lot of work. The second half of the paper is about mathematical modeling. And so I have, since about, I guess I started my PhD, I started my PhD in 1993. Were any of you born in 1993?
Yes.
Okay, Dr. Butterfield and Dr. Cooper were born. Okay, right. So I started my PhD in 1993, and I remember going from Peter, my advisor, in about 1995, and he says, you know, what we need now is we need a model. And I now realize that what he meant was a physical model. You know, like, I don't know, like blocks being pulled along by springs on a sheet of sandpaper or something. But because I had a physics degree, I thought he meant a mathematical model. And so I went away and spent a year trying to come up with a mathematical model of cross bridges. And I have sort of been doing that ever since. Right. And so one of the things that we could do on Wednesday, and I'm open to almost anything, but one of the things we could do on Wednesday is we could go through some mathematical modeling of cross bridges. Or we could talk more about this sort of stuff, or we could talk about cardiac muscle, or frankly, whatever Dr. Butterfield and Dr. Cooper would like me to do. I don't want to drag you off your syllabus.
No, but I think your computational model, that, you know, to see that in action would be really nice too. You know.
Don't you? No, I agree. No, yeah. So the interactions back to the myosin are important. I think that we've touched on some of those, and I think we'll be able to get further understanding of those, and that model will be great.
Okay. Cool. Any questions?
Questions?
This is a, you know, I mean, I think if you were going to read this paper cold, this would be a tough paper, right? I mean, it's easy for me because I did it, and it's easy for me because I've spent literally since 1993 working on this sort of stuff. But I would like to think that at least the non-modeling parts, if you read this paper now, having heard me talk about the figures, you're probably not going to get every subtlety. I actually read it last night, and I had said some stuff in the discussion that I'd completely forgotten about. Right? So there's subtleties and many layers of this. I mean, it's a long paper. It's like 20 pages long. So it's a long paper. There's subtleties in there. I'd like to think that you'd read it and you'd get a grasp of what's going on there.
I got a couple of questions.
Yeah.
Which might be related. When you did your curves and you measured your differences of stiffness, but you always moved at the same length, what about keeping... What about measuring at smaller length changes, like where you pulled it all the way apart, and then you did small changes where you could maybe only predict one or a couple of myosin heads binding, and then that way you could then come back and find out, oh, that was so many myosin heads, like a unitary change.
So, yeah, there's... So Dr. Cooper makes a good point. That paper was really very history dependent. Okay. There's any number of other things you could do. You could do stretches of different sizes. You could do stretches of different velocities. Over the years, I have done pretty much every possible combination. I've done like stretch, hold, stretch, hold, stretch, hold, stretch, hold. I've done sort of like ramp stretches, all these things. So maybe here's a subtle point, right? And this is a take-home point. Oh, yes. This is a demonstration. We can all do this, okay? So if you hold your hand there, and you look at your hand, so do you see that your hand moves a little bit? Right? It's not perfectly still. Now we do that. And then look at your hand. So what happened? So do it again. What happened? Somebody just tell me what happened. You all laughed. It moved more. Is it still moving more? Do you all? Did most of you see that? Immediately you stopped, it moved more, and then
and then
it stopped moving. Right? That is
my shake. I think it depends on how much caffeine you have.
Yeah.
That's a different. We'll talk about that, but that's a different question.
You've just measured this property. You've just measured the history dependence of your muscle stiffness. Right? Because really what's happening is you are sitting there, it's all about stability. So you've got muscles holding your hand up, muscles in the other direction, and you're very stiff for small motions. Because you're keeping all your actin and myosin and stuff together with a small number of properties. You do that, there's a big motion, interfilamentary motion. You shear all the cross bridges. And now you go back, and now your muscle isn't very stiff, so your hand wobbles around a bit. And as the actin and myosin cross bridges reform, you increase the stiffness of the muscle that's holding up, and now you stabilize again. So you measured on your hand, the short-range stiffness of your forearm muscles. So, physiologically, it makes a lot of sense to stay inside your short-range limit. Right? Because now what you do is you activate your thin filaments bit, you lock your cross bridges on, and now you're pretty stable. Okay? And cross-bridge cycling can be relatively slow, so you don't need very much ATP, so you can maintain stability at low energy cost. But then when you move,
break all the cross bridges, and now you're floppy because you're not, your muscles are not rigid. So you have to wait for the cross bridges to reform, and you will require ATP to parallel cross bridge cycle. Okay? So this gets back to Dr. Cooper's point. I don't think very much interesting happens until you stretch the muscle far enough to break the cross bridge joints. If you stretch at 1 or 2 nanometers, really all that happens is you get an elastic response. It's only when you stretch it far enough that you pull some heads off that, I mean, frankly, all bets are off at that point. And Dr. Butterfield and I have spent many years studying what are probably the consequences of going beyond the short range limit. Would you sort of agree with that? Yeah, right. It's about the only thing we agree on, muscle mechanics wise. We come from opposite ends of the explanation spectrum. But I think we do agree that when you go beyond the short range limit, all bets are off.
You mean essentially like eccentric contraction?
I mean, by short range limit, I mean a motion that is big enough to cause myosin and heads to detach. And that could be shortening, well, lengthening or shortening. Both would work. And then the stretches, the length changes might be a little bit different in each direction. It's probably a good time to stop. Okay, so we'll do some modeling the length thing. Thanks.
Sorry for the confusion at the beginning.
That's my fault. I thought I did something I didn't do, but I didn't.
Oh, that's all right.
More fun.